Hello, and welcome to our program, the National Geographic Society, brought to you by Owl Radio and the Low Vision Resource Center. I'm Jim Cruz, and during the next half hour, I'll be reading articles from National Geographic website and magazine here on Owl Radio. Our first article is Secrets of the Whales by Craig Welch. John Ford wanted a whale's eye view. One summer day in 1978, a pod of killer whales raced toward a pebbled beach on British Columbia's Vancouver Island. The young biologist was waiting in a wetsuit and snorkel. The ghostly black and white procession steamed in like a team of U-boats, low and fast. Ford pressed on his face mask, slipped into the sea. In waters barely 10 feet deep, the creatures slowed and rolled to their sides. Bodies partially submerged, the fans of at the end of their tails, their flukes, wagging. The whales began to twist and shimmy, one by one, each scuffed its side and belly on the stones, like grizzlies scratching against the pines. Ford, age 66, has now studied killer whales, the largest dolphin, and from the branch of the cetacean order known as toothed whales, for more than 40 years. He's seen this phenomenon called beach rubbing countless times since that first underwater glimpse. He can't say for certain why the animals do it. He suspects it's a form of social bonding. A larger question, though, has gnawed at him for much of his career. How come these killer whales, or orcas, do it, but not their nearly identical neighbors just to the south? Beach rubbing is routine among this population, called northern residents, because they ply inland seas during summer and fall between the Canadian mainland and Vancouver Island. Not so their neighbors to the south. The orcas around the border with Washington State, where I live, have never been documented performing this ritual. Washington's killer whales, called the southern residents, instead have their own conventions. They hold greeting ceremonies, facing off in tight lines before exploding in underwater parties of rubs and calls. That's exceedingly rare up north. Southern residents are aerialists, performing twisting leaps and belly flops. Northern residents breach far less. Some years, the southern residents push dead salmon around with their heads, not the northerners. They occasionally headbutt one another, bumping noggins like bighorn sheep. Ford says they just swim at each other and sort of collide. The two populations don't even converse with the same vocabulary. Northern residents emit an elongated, shrill, metallic squeal that sounds like air escaping balloons. Southern residents add monkey hoots and goose honks. To Ford's practice ear, the pitches and intonations sound as different as Mandarin and Swahili. Yet, in every other meaningful way, the northern and southern residents are indistinguishable. For months at a time, they occupy adjacent seas. Their ranges overlap. Although many varieties of killer whales exist around the world, the northern and southern whales share almost identical genetics. From the northern Pacific to the seas around Antarctica, killer whales also have varying diets. Some eat sharks, porpoises, penguins, and manta rays. In Patagonia, they launch onto rocky shores and pluck sea pups off the beach. In Antarctica, killer whales flush Weddell seals off floating ice, teaming up to swamp floes, and wash dinner into the drink. But the northern and southern residents are both pescatarians and eat almost one species, Chinook salmon. How could two groups from essentially the same place be genetically similar and yet speak and act so differently? For years, Ford and a few colleagues would only whisper what this paradox implied. Is it possible that these complex social beings weren't driven solely by the inherited twitch of genetic instinct? Were killer whales passing on unique traits influenced by more than their environment or their DNA? Could whales have their own cultures? The very notion seemed blasphemous. Anthropologists long had considered culture, the ability to socially accumulate and transfer knowledge strictly a human affair. But researchers had described how songbirds learn dialects and transmit them across generations. And for Ford, he proposed that killer whale groups might do the same. Then he started hearing about the findings of biologists studying a creature a world away, the sperm whale. Those scientists had been building a case that some whale species act and communicate differently based on how they're raised. It appeared these cetaceans might carry on diverse traditions, just as some humans eat with chopsticks while others use forks. Today, many scientists believe some whales and dolphins, like humans, have distinct cultures. Researchers see signs in sperm whales in the Galapagos and the Caribbean, in humpbacks across the South Pacific, in Arctic belugas, and the Pacific Northwest killer whales. The possibility is prompting new thinking about how some marine species evolve. Cultural traditions may help drive genetic shifts, altering what it means to be a whale. But this idea is also reshaping our view of what separates us from these aquatic beasts. Whale culture, it seems, is rattling time-worn conceptions of ourselves. Humans are a narcissistic breed. Throughout history, we vacillated between seeing animals through the lens of our own behavior and refusing to accept that we're anything alike. It is particularly true of whales. They're often viewed as almost human or not like us at all. We anthropomorphize or insist on our own uniqueness. Neither, of course, is entirely correct. Whales reside in a foreign place we're just coming to understand. It's hard to imagine a home less like ours. The deep ocean is a universe we've seen less of than the surface of the moon. There are mountains and rivers, but few borders. Life traverses a vertical plane, so dark that sight is of limited value. Entire relationships are forged through sound. And yet, as we spend billions scanning the heavens for alien life, the mysteries we're unraveling beneath the waves reveal foreigners here at home that are more like us than we knew. Whales' alliances, the intricacies of their conversations, and the ways they care for their young seem eerily familiar. Some may even openly mourn. In 2018, a southern resident killer whale known as Tahlequah pushed the carcass of her newborn, which had died shortly after its birth, around with her snout for 17 days. For years, scientists vigorously avoided using emotional terms like happy, sad, playful, angry when describing animal behavior, says Jay Goldos, who oversees a university program at Washington State to protect marine life through science and education. But Goldos and many whale biologists believe Tahlequah's behavior was a show of grief. When photographer Brian Scarry first mentioned his interest in exploring the culture of these remarkable animals, one group leapt to mind. I live 4 miles from Puget Sound, where three pods of southern resident killer whales spend a portion of their year zipping about in tight formations like squadrons of Air Force Thunderbirds. When their dorsal fins break the surface near shore, crowds gather with cameras, hoping to catch a memorable hop or acrobatic lunge. What secrets might these whales carry? Could knowing them help us live better together? Scientists have long understood that many whale actions must be picked up from peers or elders. It's learned behavior, and hardly shocking. Even Aristotle knew animals learn from one another. Songbirds raised away from their own families utter a different voice from their parents, he wrote. Charles Darwin noted that animal traps eventually must be moved because wild creatures imitate each other's caution. While genes determine the shape and function of a creature's body, encoding instructions for essential traits and behaviors, social learning is received wisdom. The development of neural connections that let animals learn from the knowledge of those around them. Scientists generally agree that culture requires that behaviors be socially learned and shared widely, and that they persist. As groups of animals transmit multiple learned behaviors, they can develop sets of habits wholly distinct from others of their species. For example, the ability to throw is genetic. But throwing a curveball requires social learning and playing baseball instead of cricket, and that is culture. The danger, though, is to confuse culture with intelligence. Scientists don't all agree on whether intelligence is an essential ingredient of culture. Social learning cuts widely across the animal kingdom, and not just among beings we consider, quote, smart, unquote, whales, primates, crows, and elephants. Bumblebees may choose flowers based on the behavior of experienced bees. Muon gooses learn from siblings and cousins to break open eggs or smash beetles. But being smart clearly helps. And cetaceans' capacity for learning captured our imaginations early. For decades, we packed marine-themed parks, applauding killer whales, belugas, or bottlenose dolphins that sing or vault through hoops and giant pools. These feeble attempts to corral their skills barely scratched the surface of their talents. In 1972, a scientist studying a bottlenose dolphin calf named Dolly exhaled cigarette smoke onto the window of her enclosure during a break. The observer was astonished when the animal immediately swam off to its mother, returned, and released a mouthful of milk, which engulfed her head, giving much the same effect as had the cigarette smoke. Among some whales, intelligence may even be an evolutionary response to culture, as social animals spread learned wisdom far and wide. For culture to exist, individuals must come up with new ways of doing things that get shared among peers, and whales can be shrewd innovators. A few hungry sperm whales off Alaska in the late 1990s found new ways to snack. They stripped black cod off commercial fishing boat lines. Using underwater cameras, scientists recorded a whale delicately grabbing a line with its massive jaw, creating tension, and then sliding its mouth up to the strand until the vibrations popped off a fish. The practice, previously rare, quickly spread. In the Gulf of Maine in 1980, one humpback was seen hunting in a new way. Before blowing bubbles around schools of sand lances to disorient them, the whale smacked the surface with its fluke. Humpbacks regularly use the bubble technique, but the fluke slap was new. Not clear how it helps, but by 2013, scientists counted at least 278 whales that hunted this way. For years, scientists thought animals were incapable of broad, sustained, intergenerational sharing. The notion began changing in 1953. That year, a young macaque, Emo, was spotted on Koshima Island, Japan, washing a sweet potato in a stream. Before then, the island's macaques simply wiped dirt off their food. Soon, scientists documented macaques by the dozens, washing them instead. Long after Emo died, macaques still carted potatoes to shore to dunk them in the sea. Then, in 1999, Andrew Whitten, a cognitive scientist with Scotland's University of St. Andrews, published a landmark paper with primate experts including Jane Goodall. They noted that dozens of chimpanzee traditions, grooming, rain dancing, strutting about at the first signs of precipitation, cracking nuts with hammers, poking termite mounds with sticks, appeared across some chimp communities, but not others. Whitten says, if you watch a chimpanzee long enough and check out these behaviors, you can pretty much tell where that chimp comes from. And watching people behave is often how we identify human culture. Not everyone is convinced. Some researchers argue that genetic or environmental variables could have prompted some of these behaviors. Chimpanzees weren't all the same subspecies. They ranged from coastal Guinea to Uganda, 2,700 miles apart. Far enough, some suggest that ecological differences could have influenced the primates' activities. But a new way of thinking about wildlife behavior and group culture, less centered on humans, has taken root. And as Whitten and others built on their initial work, skeptics found claims harder to dismiss, especially when it came to creatures longer than city buses that use sound to find their prey a mile below the sea surface. Whoa! Whoa, right there, Shane Giro shouts, and begins counting. 8 sperm whales bob off our port side, half submerged in the cobalt Caribbean. Their gunmetal gray and as smooth and cylindrical as airplane fuselages. The whales are taking a breather, literally. They just surface to draw oxygen deep into their enormous squared-off heads. Soon, they'll dive and use some of that air to converse. We're aboard the Balena, a 40-foot sailboat swaying offshore of the West Indies island nation of Dominica. The tiny country's rain-soaked peaks, now shrouded in mist, are partly why we're here. Those small green mountains block gales and keep deep leeward waters calm. Ideal conditions for studying sperm whales. And Jiro, crisscrossing the deck barefoot in board shorts, has studied more sperm whale families up close than perhaps any other human in history. Since 2005, this adjunct professor at Denmark's Aarhus University and Canada's Carleton and Dalhousie universities has come to this glittering swirl of sargassum and spray to study these leviathans. Rather than finding a monomaniac incarnation of malicious agencies, as Herman Melville described the sperm whale in Moby Dick, Jiro sees peaceful, playful animals. He can identify dozens on sight. There is Can Opener, who toys with researchers, pulling close to their vessel before rolling sideways to eyeball Jiro's crew. There's Digit, who almost perished after swimming through fishing gear that lassoed her tail, nearly amputating it while preventing her from diving to eat. She has since healed. The one with the serrated fluke is called Knife. The one with the weird scoop in his was Spoon. The whales he knows are local, island specialists, Jiro tells me. He follows them as they move through underwater canyons off Dominica, between the islands of Guadalupe and Martinique. He has tracked them sleeping, giving birth, nursing, making their first dives, playing with cousins, and dying. He's recorded them swimming deeper than most submarines travel. He knows their lives so intimately his kids at home recite their names. But today, after more than a week at sea, we woke to find the locals gone, replaced by 8 outsiders riding swells around us. Jiro's gregarious by nature, yet this is the most excited I've seen him. He's shouting for students to drop underwater recorders, called hydrophones. He warns them to get their cameras ready to photograph flukes, which, like fingerprints, help identify individual whales as they dive. These new whales are animals he barely knows, itinerant vagabonds from a second whale community. They occasionally share space with the regulars, but never interact with them. To me, they're sleek and glorious, but not so different from the local whales we spotted yesterday. To Jiro, they are unmistakable evidence that Dominica is home to parallel whale traditions, two cultures as divergent as farmers and nomadic hunter-gatherers. The roots of this knowledge come from the man helming our sailboat, Jiro's mentor Hal Whitehead. Curly mopped, hat brim blown skyward by wind, the professor at Dalhousie University steadies our craft with one eye on our visitors. Sperm whales travel in lifelong female-led social units. Males are squeezed out in their early teens, units of about a dozen. In the 1980s and 90s, Whitehead tracked some of these social units across the Galapagos, partly as an excuse to live at sea. He says, I just became really interested in them. He and Lou Crandell, a researcher at the University of St. Andrews, started unspooling their cultural mysteries by documenting patterns of sperm whale chatter. Sperm whales use the world's largest brains to operate nature's largest sonar system. They send pressurized air through their snout, creating clicking sounds. They string those clicks together in rhythmic codas, rather like Morse code. Each coda lasts seconds or less. Some are 3 clicks, some may be a dozen or more. Over decades, Whitehead recorded clicks by the thousands. He had no clue what the whales were saying, but one day in his lab in Nova Scotia, Whitehead created a chart summarizing recording data from all these whale groups. He spotted a trend. Roughly half made a common repertoire of calls. Their codas had similar patterns. Other units used different arrangements. I was blown away, Whitehead recalls. He bounded up concrete steps to Rendell's office. Rendell got it too. These small whale units were part of something bigger, whale clans of hundreds or thousands, and each clan speaking its own dialect. Why would these animals, many of which had never met, have shared common calls? It's a group moniker, the men theorize, a way to say, "I'm one of you." They knew small groups spent time with others in their clan, but never with outsiders. And in the inky black of the sea, sound as hell, they'd see who was around. Whitehead suspected click quotas were similar to human markers of cultural identity. Think, he says, of the gear worn by English Premier League soccer fans. The Manchester United supporters parade around with a red scarf. The Manchester City, blue scarf. Whitehead tells me, as dust settles over the Caribbean, they don't all know each other and don't mingle, yet fans find their way to pubs to watch matches together. It suggests this higher-level thing that's really important to the whales, Whitehead says. Over time, he, Rendell, and others also documented that whales in two distinct clans in the Galapagos had startlingly different habits. In one, whales cruised the sea in meandering formations, while in the other they swam in straight lines. One clan stayed close to land, the other moved farther offshore. During El Niño periods, when waters are warmed, whales in both clans struggled to get enough food, but one clan had a harder time than the other. For whales, it appears, quote, there's this boundary between us who learn from each other and do things one way, Garrow explains, and they who don't learn from us and do things differently. The idea that whales have cultures at all, let alone that they segregate themselves into cultural groups as humans do, was controversial when Whitehead and Rendell presented it in 2001. One British anthropologist sneered, "It is sad to see such rich empirical material about such wonderful creatures harnessed to such an impoverished theoretical agenda." Well, 20 years later, some skepticism remains. I would never say that sperm or killer whales do not have culture, but I would say that the evidence for culture is stronger in many other animal species, such as humpbacks and songbirds, says Peter Tyack, a scientist from Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, who studies cetacean communication. Genetics, animal development, and the environment can work in complex ways that make it hard to definitively link behavior to culture. It's essential for scientists to be honest and humble about how little we know about the cultures of any animal species. And yet, whale scientists increasingly embrace Whitehead's view, says Sarah Mesnick, with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. She says it's gaining acceptance because more and more people observe it. Giro, for example, found similar divisions among sperm whale clans in an entirely different sea than his mentor, the Caribbean. And Giro's ability to drill down into life with individual whales has strengthened Whitehead's case. One afternoon, we spot a female sperm whale named Rounder. She's floating at the surface with two calves, only one of which is hers. Baby whales don't dive deep for squid, Euro explains, so an adult protector stays topside as the unit hunts, and they're watching Rounder babysit. Every unit does this differently. Some let the young slip beneath their bellies to suck. The other, in some units, calves get watched by non-relatives, but get milk only from mom. In Rounder's group, moms and grandmothers share babysitting and nursing duties, but only for calves in their bloodline. In another, one female plays wet nurse to two calves at once, even though neither is hers. Giro has discovered that small units within clans appear to emit family-specific codas, something like surnames, while individuals communicate in click patterns with subtle signature variations like first names. Using nothing but clicks, Giro can tell which whale in a unit is speaking about 80% of the time. He says, way better than random chance. Giro even recorded baby sperm whales making random clicks before winnowing their repertoire. they were zeroing in on their clan's dialect, like infants babbling before saying, Mama. They were acquiring cultural norms before him in real time. The big question now is whether some of these whale communities will survive long enough for us to understand their cultures. Few know better this than Ford, the Canadian killer whale biologist. As a teenager, he swept popcorn off the floor and fed seals and belugas at the Vancouver Aquarium. He would go on to discover distinct orca dialects before leading West Coast whale research for the Canadian government. When I ask about resilience during one of our many talks, Ford shares a story. Killer whales travel in matrilineal family pods for life and learn how and what to eat by watching their kin. In 1970, when wild orcas in the region were still being caught for marine parks, wranglers drove five killer whales into a British Columbia cove. They were taken to a marine park. The remaining three refused to eat the salmon offered by caretakers. One eventually died. Only after 79 days did the survivors start eating fish. The whales were caught in a behavioral rut. The caretakers didn't know killer whales in the Northwest represent three different diets: southern and northern resident salmon eaters, coastal shark eaters, and big killer whales, which hunt only marine mammals. Unlike some other cetaceans, whose cultural offers them flexibility, these killer whales are unwilling and unable to switch food even when options dwindle. Such as Norwegian explorer Roald Amundsen beat Robert Falcon Scott, a Brit, to the South Pole by eating his sled dogs, which Scott refused to do. It's just an example of how ingrained these cultures are, Ford says. Decimated by culling from marine parks in the 60s and 70s, the southern residents now battle noise from boat traffic. Development crowds their shores, dumps silt in their waters, brings pollution. Toxic chemicals such as PCBs have built up in their blubber. All of that is made far worse by a drastic shortage of food as Chinook populations plummet, thanks to years of fishing, dam building, development, and change. These sophisticated alien beings are quite literally vanishing before our eyes. Not so different from South America's pre-Inca Tiahuanaco Empire, which left no written record of its 12th century collapse. We don't know what might disappear with them. We can't explain why they act as they do, or why they're so unlike other whales. But at least we're beginning to acknowledge that what's at stake is rich and important in ways we may not fully comprehend. You've been listening to the National Geographic Society here on Owl Radio. Now, you can listen to Owl Radio on our specially tuned radio or by streaming on your computer or smartphone. You may also listen to at your convenience on our podcast at www.owlradio.org. This program will be replayed after 9 p.m. this evening. Until next time, this is Jim Cruz saying goodbye from Owl Radio.